Playing with a beach ball does not involve throwing it back and forth. It involves her sitting there and receiving the beach ball on her forehead. Toss it. Bam! Bounces off. She thinks this is funnier than hell. Bam! Bounces back. I got pretty good at it. It always brought, no matter what, her father comes back, picks her up, and I pick up the volley beach ball, and she looks at me, and I can tell she wants me to throw it again. Bam! I hit her right while she's sitting with her grand, with her father. She's laughing away, and he looks over at me. What are you doing? Beating the hell out of her with a beach ball. It's really fun. So funny. What a kid. There's a sense of humor for you. Pure humor. But what I was going to tell you about besides that amusing incident was that the whole concept of equal employment, as far as we've gone so far, and we've got a couple more to cover today briefly, the idea being here is to get the best employees and don't automatically drop people because they don't particularly belong to a protected group that you like, right? Not hiring any druids or whatever it might happen to be. Because you're going to lose good people, or at least the opportunity to get good people. That's point one. Point two is that the law on this is reasonably firm, and since it's usually that a claim is brought about by an employee, the employee makes a complaint that can't be solved internally. They always have to consider an internal solution before they go to the EEOC, the enforcement agency. When the EEOC gets involved, you can almost be sure that you're going to have an expensive settlement in one form or fashion because they're going to investigate how you do business, how you hire people. You're going to have your own attorney there when they send their attorneys over. Remember that the EEOC is an advocate agency which argues for the person who's complaining. So they are not on your side. They're not a neutral agency. They are trying to help the employee make a claim in a situation where, by definition, the employee is right since the claim has been issued. It may turn out that they're not. But the general consensus is the employee is right about complaining about your company. So this means you need an attorney present at all times when they come and look at your records or talk to other employees or the like. You should have an attorney there to make sure that the claim isn't too old. It needs to be based on an event that happened in the last 6 months, and that your company has at least 15 or more employees. I may or may not have mentioned these things to you, but your attorney will help make sure that the wrong thing isn't done, whereas you're concerned. So be sure to have an attorney with you. If this ends up going to court after a reconciliation where the EEOC and the company and the employee try to reconcile the problems, if it ends up going to court, you've got an expensive situation building in front of you because, of course, all the legal fees that you're going to have is the company, which the employee doesn't have because the EEOC is representing them. So right off the bat, you're going to have those costs. It's not, on an hourly basis, not that expensive, a couple hundred bucks an hour, or more, depending on the quality of the attorney. But this stuff adds up over time. And in an adverse treatment claim, which, remember, is intentional, right? Intentional one-to-one discrimination based on protected group. Since it's intentional, the awards that go to the employee are substantially higher than if it's inadvertent, in other words, adverse impact. So an adverse treatment claim can be up to, generally speaking, $300,000. There are exceptions which will allow it to go much, much higher. But for the time being, it's reasonably expensive at $300,000. But by the time you add attorney fees, court costs, and the like, you're talking $500,000 in many cases. So be careful about adverse treatment claims. Adverse impact claims are also bad, even though they're not going to cost you as much. Usually it's just what's known as compensable damages, which is people's getting their money for the time they lost or the benefits that they didn't get, and job reinstatement, typically. So these compensable benefits coming out of an adverse impact situation are not that bad. But an adverse treatment situation is a different kettle of fish and something you need to be concerned about. So do be careful about this. You want the best employees anyway.
Yeah.
Could you countersue with like a slander claim or something if they...
Well, slander, you know, be it slander or libel, written or spoken, you have a situation where you're going to have to prove that what was said was untrue. And by the time that this gets to the EEOC has decided to investigate it, I'd say that 99% of the time it's true. They don't waste their time on a case that isn't true. So in terms of slander and libel, we'll talk about slander and libel when we get to recommendation forms and stuff like that and trying to get a job and this and that. But I wouldn't think it would work in this situation. I haven't heard of it working. But it's up to you to do what's right for your company. As a manager, you're going to want to be sure that you're very careful about getting the best employees and not illegally discriminating against a protected group. We all understand the one-to-one aspect of this. We know that's illegal. But the adverse impact aspect of this, having job requirements on your selection process that don't really match the job itself and hurt a protected group, can create a problem for the company as well. Not as expensive, but still a pain to have to deal with. So please be careful through all of this stuff. And if it looks like you're going to have an EEO suit, get a freaking attorney. There's no, you know, somebody who specializes in employment law. Get them in there and get the attorney to mitigate the problems that are bound to come up if you don't have an attorney. Okay. Past that, let's talk about the two pieces of legislation that I want to hit today. The ADA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. And the second piece of legislation is the ADEA, Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Those two pieces of legislation are important today since they one of them addresses the fact that we have a growing older workforce. Baby boomers are getting old like me, and so you have a huge part of the population that's in the protected group of 40 and above under the ADA. But let's talk about the ADA first. The ADA, Americans with Disabilities, recognizes that the country as a whole stereotypes disabled people as being less abled in general. So if a person has a particular type of crippling disease or has a speech impediment or has physical limitations on their movement, they're quite often seen as less abled mentally and physically and consequently discriminated against when applying for jobs. So this piece of legislation protects people who have an impairment to a major life function, is how it's written. Impairment to a major life function under the ADA, disability. A disability is an impairment to a major life function as per the Act. I mean, we would, you know, sometimes think of a disability. You're just going to have trouble getting that job with that, you know, 100-pound weight shackled to your leg. Well, that's not what they would consider that something else, some weird eccentricity on your part. But that's not considered disability. I ran into a fellow working at my house the other day who had dreadlocks under his cap that came down to the back of his knees. Is that going to be a disability in terms of getting a job? Will it hurt him trying to get a job? My belief is yes. It probably will. It cuts out a lot of possible jobs. Is it covered under this Act? No. It's not an impairment to a major life function. Hair growing isn't covered. So what we're looking at here is a distinction between an actual disability and one that we socially consider a disability. Dreadlocks in the back of your knees is a social disability, in my opinion. Maybe not. Maybe you young kids are better than I am at that. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. That guy could lift 200 pounds. That's all I cared about. I had log sections to move, and he moved them. So that was fine. But from the point of view of getting a job, in many situations, that would be difficult. We may have talked about this in class, about visible tattoos. Did we talk about this in here or in the other class? Same idea. A visible tattoo, is that possibly a disability to getting some jobs?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah.
You don't think so?
Yeah, sometimes.
I think sometimes. I think there's a big change coming along in that. Certainly 30 years ago it was a huge. Now less so. But in general, I still think it's going to hurt you to have an invisible tattoo. And I don't see any value in having it in terms. I'm going to get this tattoo because I know it's going to help me get a job at Dr. Fox because there's going to be a big screaming eagle flying across my face. It'd be really cool. It'd be visible. I'm not sure it would help you get a job. So, but that's not considered to be something that you've done to yourself like that would not be considered a disability. It's more of a natural disability, something that's a life, you know, it's considered to be a life function. So, what we're looking at here then is for the company to look at people based on qualifications and ignore the disability. Just investigate whether the person is qualified for the job. Yes, they have a misshapen leg. One of my brother-in-laws has a misshapen leg and has trouble walking. But should that disqualify him from any number of jobs that involve desk work, keyboard entry or program writing or blog writing or whatever it might happen to be? All that stuff could be done. Even though people might discriminate against him because of his bum leg. Who knows? So it's to get away from that. The proscription on that, in other words, what you can't do also is to discriminate against people who had a disability and it was cured. So if my brother-in-law had his leg fixed and he could work perfectly, walk perfectly, and you still discriminated against him because he used to have a disability, that would also be illegal. Or if a relative of someone has a disability and you want to discriminate against them because you don't want them on the medical policy or something, your company, could also be illegal. So what it's looking for is for you to not discriminate against people based on their disability if the person is qualified for the job. You're also required to make what's known as reasonable accommodation. That's a term that I need you to know. Term. I have to underline word terms so that you can't put in kitchen sink. Term. Reasonable accommodation. Reasonable accommodation is spending a reasonable amount of money based on the firm's financial abilities to correct a workplace so that a disabled individual can work there. So, if you had all your computers in one section, everybody was writing programs, you could pay for some form of Wi-Fi connection to put a computer on a different floor and to run a cable down or whatever necessary so that a person with a bum leg wouldn't have to go up a set of steps or some such. Or put a parking place closer for them so they didn't have to hike across a large parking area, etc. So you're to make reasonable accommodations if your company can normally afford. This means that more wealthy companies are supposed to have to spend more. But in reality, the literature shows that the average reasonable accommodation cost is under $2,000. It's not very expensive. That's what it comes down to. Adjusting for someone's being in a wheelchair or someone's disability being able to see very well, see a monitor very well, whatever it might happen to be, this stuff can be corrected fairly easily. There's obviously plenty of programs you can get that increase the size of the print on screen, because you can now get screens the size of your wall. So between these things, you can probably put together a usable work spot. I interviewed for a job at Western Kentucky back in the day when I was looking for work. One of the professors was blind, and he had a reader. The school paid for a reader to read him articles and read stuff out of the newspaper that he wanted to incorporate into his class notes. It's pretty interesting. So, reasonable accommodation is an important consideration in the adjustment of your workforce, your workplace. You do not have to pay a lot, is what I'm getting down to. The Americans with Disabilities Act also ran into an interesting problem early on, because the Americans with Disabilities Act would take a look at, well, how many of you have been drug screened for jobs? Yeah, a lot of you, and you all will be, no matter what job it is. Eventually, you're going to be drug screened. Initially, the drug screening ran afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act, because you would come into a place where you wanted a job, the first thing they would do would be a drug screen. And the results of that drug screen would be that you either did or did not have a potentially illegal drug in your system. What made a drug legal or illegal?
Whether or not you had a prescription for
exactly. Thank you. If you had a prescription, it was a legal drug, and they should not be discriminating against you because you have a legal drug in your system. But the companies were using this information. They would say, for example, why are you taking these pain pills that you have this prescription for? And you'd say, because I have a bad back. Then the next day you'd get a letter saying you're not going to be hired by our company. What would be the assumption?
You're going to work hard on pain pills.
You don't have a bad back.
You have a bad back.
Running.
Yeah, it could be either way. It could be. But generally speaking, the company said, well, he already has his physical disability, and we don't want to have to pay for it when he has to go see the doctor through our medical plan. So they were discriminating against people because of information they found out about drug usage, which is required under the Drug-Free Act, Drug-Free Workplace Act. So they would screen, they'd find out a person is legally using a drug, and yet they would use that information to determine that the person should not be hired because of some bad back, bad pain problem, whatever it might happen to be. So now, because of that situation, the ADA requires that the drug testing, looking for drug testing, happens after you have conditionally offered a person a job. So you don't pee in the bottle or whatever until after they have conditionally offered you the job, passing the drug test. In other words, you're not taking an illegal drug. So that was a major change in how this is done, and certainly a worthwhile one. But the ADA is obviously an important consideration, particularly now with drug use, alcoholism, and the like, at high rate. Both of those you can screen against. You can screen against if it's pre-job hire. So if you say, if you have a policy, we don't hire people who have drinking problems, completely legitimate. We don't hire people who are using drugs illegally, obviously that's legitimate. But the question gets raised is, what happens when a person starts using drugs on the job that you've hired them for, or start drinking on the job? Is it considered protected at that point? And the answer is short, sort of. What the court's looking for in an alcohol use on the job after having been hired by you, or drug use after having been hired by you, is that the company has attempted to help the employee. I'm sorry, but that's how I boil down the information. And it sounds like sort of an imprecise thing, but if the company has, for example, put in an EAP, Employee Assistance Program, an EAP for drugs or an EAP for alcohol, that goes a long way to show that the company cared about this employee and only has let them go because, or fired them because of the inability to cure them of their problem. And they can also document that people who are drunk on the job and are using drugs on the job are very costly in terms of accidents, poor quality control, and the like. So EAPs are recommended. EAPs, the literature perpetually shows that an EAP pays off for a company. They put a dollar in, they get $3 back in terms of less accidents, better work habits, better work on the job, et cetera, attendance, and that kind of thing. So EAPs, Employee Assistance Program, are recommended by the courts and by me as well. So I would encourage you to use that for people who have run afoul of drugs and alcohol on the job once you've already hired them. As a side note, I recommend you also put in place something that's slowly and infinitely slowly becoming more common, which is computer-based sobriety tests. So computer-based sobriety tests are not breathing into the machine. They're hand-eye coordination. When the first day on the job, you establish a baseline for how quickly you can solve a hand-eye coordination problem. And then each day after that, they test you against that problem. And if you're impaired, it shows that your time is so slow to get to this hand-eye coordination problem solution, and they don't let you work that day because you're seen to be impaired. And so I strongly recommend companies do that. You may consider doing that for your company. It keeps people from getting into safety positions where they can cause problems. We had one in Boone a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, where a trash truck went by a woman's house, stopped at the next house. The woman came up, you know, with her trash to put it in the back of the truck because the truck had driven by her house. The guy who was stoned backed up and squashed her. So they did a drug test. Turned out he was stoned. And the only thing you could say is it's a little late now. It would have been a lot better to know a couple hours earlier that he shouldn't have been driving. And the computer-based coordination, hand-eye coordination type of testing to determine if a person's sober is a good thing. Keep people off the job. We're using this on our railroads now for engineers and whatnot. So more and more that kind of testing is good and keeps people who have problems off the job. Back that up with an EAP to try and cure the people, you're going to be in good shape in terms of what the courts will be expecting of you. Okay, the ADEA, which is the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. The Age Discrimination and Employment Act, all of these are enforced under Title VII, I might add. Not under Title VII, but by the EEOC. So these are EEOCs in terms of adverse impact, adverse treatment. It all stands to good stead here. All is consistent throughout. And the court processes, et cetera. But the Age Discrimination Employment Act creates a new protected group, which, as you might imagine, is the protected group of over 39, but let's just say 40 and above. Age of 40 and above are protected as a new protected group. Companies has historically had a long history of laying older people off because they're seen as less trainable, right? That their hand-eye coordination is good, their vision isn't as good, they just can't make adjustments, and blah, blah, blah. We don't want to have a young and new vibrant image. We have all our employees drinking Pepsi-Cola so that we look young and dynamic, et cetera, and so we canned all these people. Also, please note, usually the older people have been there the longest and consequently have accumulated increases in pay through seniority. So they're often the more highly paid employees, so they get laid off. This is, if they're 40 or older, that would be a violation under the ADEA. In general, if you're going to be laying people off, you should not be looking at age, you should be looking at job performance. There's quite a few examples of people who had very high job performance and gotten letters of commendation from the CEO who a month later are laid off because they're, quote, too old. So it's absurd. They can sue and easily do and collect. So don't think people who are older are necessarily unable to do various jobs. I know some things decrease in terms of reaction time and the like. And the general concern companies have is, well, as these people get older, aren't they going to run up higher medical costs? Legitimate concern. But weigh that against what's the negatives of younger employees. You tell me, as a younger employee, what would be the negative of hiring younger employees? Pardon?
Less experience.
Well, less experience, for sure.
Not dependent as far as interest in
insurance goes, about kids and maybe a wife or something?
Possibly, but both might have that.
Less
but what's, pardon?
Less commitment.
I think that's true. Less commitment and more interest in, since there's a general consensus that you're going to have, what? What is it now, 30 to 40 jobs before you retire? 50, 100? I don't know how many it is, but it's a hell of a lot. And so you expect that you're going to change jobs, right? It's, it may be true for some jobs, but not for others. I've been here for all these years, and I didn't particularly feel like changing either. So what we're looking at here is older people don't change jobs as often. They have long-time experience. Right? They don't have commitments like little children that they have to move to a daycare because the mother's sick that day and somebody's got to take the kid to the daycare, so that doesn't happen. So there's a lot of aspects that are offset against the possible weight against the medical plan. It's, in my opinion, roughly evens it out. I'd like to see a study on it, you know, the actual monetary value of this. But older employees are essentially as a protected group, except for there, of course, BFOQs. As I mentioned to you, that there would be some typical Title VII stuff here. There are several, really only, basically it's several, but it boils down to one. The BFOQ for older people is that you don't have to hire an older person, even if they're qualified, if it involves public transportation, which is kind of interesting. For a while, it was airplane pilots, that you couldn't be an official pilot after a certain age. That's been modified slightly. But still, airline pilots, long-haul bus drivers and truck drivers, that kind of stuff, where public well-being as seen as a possible problem. So the ADEA is another stereotype law, response to stereotypes, that older people are too busy trying to find their glasses so they can't work very well. But in reality, there's a lot of people that waste a lot of time at work, and it's not necessarily just older people. Obviously, older people waste time, but obviously younger people waste time too. And in terms of singling out a group, it's not seen as, from a society's point of view, a good thing to say that everybody above 40 and above is incompetent. So keep that in mind. That's it for today. I'll see you all Tuesday. And on Tuesday, I'm going to bring in, if I can remember, I'm going to bring in the sheet that talks to you about your group term paper, which I'm sure you're going to be glad to see.